generation. In fact, it soon became clear that it was smart business for a company to start work on the product that would render obsolete its latest and greatest offering well before the first one even made it to market. That's how fast things would change in the tech marketplace that was just beginning to materialize. And each of the system's three underlying technologies was improving independently at its own breathtaking pace. So there was always more leverage to be had by employing the latest, greatest building blocks as they became available. The great technology CEOs could impose rigor on their companies and yet accept the fact that all this rapid change would eventually disrupt their operations anyway. Mike Scott was not a great CEO. He had the skills and personality of a COO, a chief operating officer. When he didn't get the stability he so avidly tried to engineer, he became frazzled. And thanks in great part to Steve, Scotty didn't achieve a whole lot of stability at Apple. Steve certainly knew, intellectually, that he needed the orderly and well-oiled basic operations of a corporation to achieve his vision. But he was enamored with instability. His vision was based on destabilizing the existing computer industry. Stability was a quality that IBM had, and Apple, in Steve's mind, was the anti-IBM. Needless to say, the arranged marriage between one man who embraced uncertainty and another who craved stability was not destined to last. A harbinger of its eventual demise occurred in the first couple of weeks after Scotty arrived at Apple. He had to assign numbers to the workplace badges everyone wore around the new Stevens Creek Boulevard office. When he decided that Woz would be employee number one, Steve went to him and whined. It didn't take long till Scotty relented and gave Steve a new, customized tag. Employee number zero. In part because of the way Steve quarreled with Markula and Scott, in part because he so brazenly asserted his opinions as fact, and in part because, over the length of his career, he neglected to share credit for Apple's successes in the press, Steve developed a reputation as an egomaniac who wasn't willing to learn from others. It's a fundamental misunderstanding of the man, even during his youngest, brashest, and most overbearing years. While Steve looked to his elders at Apple for guidance, he also sought it out elsewhere. He didn't yet have the skills to build a great company, but he admired those who had pulled it off, and he would go to great lengths to meet them and learn from them. None of these people were really in it for the money, he told me. Dave Packard, for example, left all his money to his foundation. He may have died to the richest guy in the cemetery, but he wasn't in it for the money. Bob Noyce, co-founder of Intel, is another. I'm old enough to have been able to get to know these guys. I met Andy Grove, CEO of Intel, from 1987 to 1998 when I was 21. I called him up and told him I had heard he was really good at operations, and asked if I could take him out to lunch. I did that with Jerry Sanders, founder of Advanced Micro Devices, and with Charlie Spork, founder of National Semiconductor, and others. Basically, I got to know these guys who were all company builders, and the particular scent of Silicon Valley at that time made a very big impression on me. Most of these older men enjoyed sparring with and advising someone this glib, smart, and anxious to learn. Of course, they didn't work with him, which lowered the stakes on the relationship considerably. Some were heroes whom he only met once or twice, like Edwin Land, the founder of Polaroid. Steve admired many things about Land, among them his obsessive commitment to creating products of style, practicality, and great consumer appeal, like the groundbreaking SX70, the folding camera that wowed America in the 1970s. His reliance on gut instinct rather than consumer research, and the restless obsession and invention he brought to the company he founded. Others became lifelong advisors. Grove served as a behind-the-scenes counselor to Steve at several critical moments in his career, despite the fact that Apple, until 2006, was the one major computer company whose machines didn't run on Intel chips. Jobs deeply respected Grove. a Hungarian Jew who survived a Nazi labor camp, fascism, an aborted revolution, and the prolonged Russian siege of Budapest, who lost most of his hearing at age 4 from a severe case of scarlet fever, and who made his way to Ellis Island on his own after fleeing the communist regime as a teenager. Grove is as tough and pragmatic as any businessman around. But he is also, just as Steve was, a well-rounded person with wide-ranging interests. At City College of New York, he mastered English, including its most scathing expletives, which he could hurl with astonishing venom, thanks in part to his Hungarian accent. His combination of pragmatism and expansiveness was something Steve admired, something he aspired to himself. Grove is the third member, along with Jobs and Bill Gates, of the triumvirate that brought personal computing to the masses. He came into his own after he signed on as the first employee at Intel Corporation, which was founded in 1968 by fellow Fairchild engineers Robert Noyce and Gordon Moore, the originator in 1965 of Moore's Law. That law was an observation about the price and performance of semiconductors that no one before him had noticed, namely that the number of transistors that could be etched on a single chip of a given size doubled every 18 months or so, without any corresponding increase in the cost. It was Grove who best understood just how intricate and difficult it was to actually make reliable semiconductor components on a scale that computer makers like IBM, Sperry, and Burroughs could count on. In that sense, he was the one who transformed Moore's Law into a business model, allowing the computer industry to expect predictable gains on a fairly regular timetable. Grove was famous for hard-nosed, seemingly counterintuitive strategic decisions, including, famously, abandoning the memory chips that accounted for almost all of Intel's revenues and switching Intel's operations over to making microprocessors for the emerging categories of personal computers, engineering workstations, and bigger systems that would come to be known as file servers. His flexible, sophisticated approach to management set a high standard for Silicon Valley companies. He even wrote a popular management column for the San Jose Mercury News. Noyce, the Intel co-founder who pioneered the development of integrated circuits, was another early hero. Jobs and Wozniak presented the Apple II to Noyce and the rest of the Intel board in 1977. While Noyce appreciated the technology, he didn't appreciate the two young men, with their long hair and shabby attire. But Steve pursued Noyce, and over the years, the two became friends. Noyce's wife, Ann Bowers, was an early investor in the company, and in 1980, she even became Apple's first vice president of human resources. Steve's relationships with outside mentors could be very personal. Steve wanted that family thing, remembers Regis McKenna. He used to come over and just sit at the kitchen table with me and my wife. Diane McKenna, an urban planner who at one point became mayor of Sunnyvale. He always wanted to talk to her when he called up. She and I always had the sense that he wanted a family, that he really wanted that. He used to come over from Apple to fix things on my Apple II. I would tell him, Steve, you've got more important things to do than that. But he'd insist on coming over. Besides, he'd tell me, then I get to chat with Diane. Partly because he is so personable, partly because Markula asked him to work for Apple as an advisor, and partly because his expertise is in something that Steve found instinctually appealing, marketing, McKenna became Steve's most significant early mentor. McKenna was expert at presenting a company's tale, but he was also a master corporate business strategist. Silicon Valley has long depended on marketers nearly as much as it has depended on engineers. Every technological advance must be framed in a beguiling narrative if it's to get off the workbench and into businesses or homes. These advances often are foreign concepts, after all, with potential that seems opaque if not daunting. So the job of a great marketer is to wrestle the concept back to earth and make it approachable for mere technophobic mortals. McKenna's consultancy would have a hand in the creation of many of the elite companies in Silicon Valley and beyond, including National Semiconductor, Silicon Graphics, Electronic Arts, Compaq, Intel, and Lotus Software. McKenna quickly saw that Steve was unusually articulate and driven. "He had what I'd call Silicon Valley street smarts," says McKenna. "You know how certain kids who grow up in the inner city know where to go to get what, and how the power structure of the neighborhood works? Here, you're likely to live next door to an electrical engineer or software programmer, and a smart and curious kid can learn a lot just by wandering around and paying attention." From junior high on, Steve was out there figuring things out. The two spent many hours in the basement of McKenna's ranch-style Sunnyvale home, talking about Steve's goals for Apple and its wondrous Apple II. Their conversations ranged widely over design, marketing, product development, and strategy, and how these were intertwined in a healthy business. McKenna was expert at framing a company's development in a narrative Steve could relate to. "We talked about how your financials are your best marketing tools," says McKenna. "To get people to sit up and pay notice, especially in the computer business, you need to be a successful financial company." McKenna was absorbed and engaged by Steve. He was very pleasant and enjoyable and had a lot of depth intellectually. He could talk about a wide range of subjects. "We could have real trivial conversations, and then we could talk about Apple and the business. I remember him once asking me if I thought Apple would ever be bigger than Intel. The answer, of course, is that Intel was a component manufacturer, and usually the equipment manufacturers get much bigger in revenue." McKenna and Jobs connected on so many levels that Regis got to know Steve as well as anyone during those early years. It helped that he didn't tolerate any of Steve's more obnoxious behavior. "He did have that quick, reactive temper, but I never had him shout at me. I never had him upset with me. Did we disagree? Yeah. Did we argue? Yes. But we also got along really, really well," he remembers. "I had an assistant who told me that Steve called up wanting something and had yelled and yelled at her, using a lot of four-letter words. Next time I saw Steve, I told him, 'Hey, don't ever do that again.' She said the next time he came to the office, he walked in and said he was really embarrassed and apologized. I was trained in the semiconductor industry under Charlie Spork and Don Valentine and those guys. If you weren't strong, they'd just gobble you up. So it didn't bother me to say, 'Hey, Steve, shut up.' He didn't dominate you to be mean, but when people acted as minions, he let them be minions." McKenna and his team worked with Steve to craft a marketing pitch designed to make the Apple II stand out as the friendly computer for more than just computer geeks. The headline of the first promotional brochure McKenna created for the machine asserted, "Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication." It was a concept that went against every industry trend, since most of the existing manufacturers, including Commodore and MITS and Vector Graphic, advertised in the hobbyist rags with endless gray type that alerted obsessive geeks to this or that great new feature. Friendly marketing would distinguish Apple from its competitors for decades. McKenna also helped Steve understand the value of presenting this image across every platform the company touched. Early on, he convinced Steve that since there was nothing remotely quaint about Apple's computers, the company would need an unmistakably modern visual identity, rather than Ronald Wayne's archaic etching, which was more appropriate for a Berkeley head shop than a company that hoped to lead a global revolution in computing. The replacement was the now famous Apple with the bite taken out and five exuberant rainbow stripes, each fitting perfectly atop the other, as Steve insisted. It seemed sharp and modern, and seemed to promise that computing from Apple would be something much more fun and easy than those mainframes from IBM, with its sober, stratified, white initials against a deep blue palette, almost like a pinstriped suit laid sideways. As Steve explained at the time, "Our whole company is founded on the principle that there is something very different that happens with one person, one computer, It's very different than having 10 people to one computer. What we're trying to do is remove the barrier of having to learn how to use a computer. Like McKenna, Steve had the gift of being able to explain profoundly complicated technology in simple, clear, and even rhapsodic terms. McKenna and Jobs knew this was a profound asset for Apple, especially given the company's other nondescript leaders. There's a long and wonderful extemporaneous quote from a New Yorker piece in late 1977 that offers rich proof of Steve's fully formed verbal mastery. Written at a time when the average reader knew so little about computers, that a writer could delight in titillating terminology like naked computer and get away with obvious puns using the words byte and apple. The magazine's reporter encountered Steve manning the Apple computer booth at a computer fair. "I wish we'd had these personal machines when I was growing up," Jobs tells him, before continuing on for a total of 224 words. People have been hearing all sorts of things about computers during the past 10 years through the media. Supposedly, computers have been controlling various aspects of their lives. Yet in spite of that, most adults have no idea what a computer really is, or what it can or can't do. Now, for the first time, people can actually buy a computer for the price of a good stereo, interact with it, and find out all about it. It's analogous to taking apart 1955 Chevys. Or consider the camera. There are thousands of people across the country taking photography courses. They'll never be professional photographers. They just want to understand what the photographic process is all about. Same with computers. We started a little personal computer manufacturing company in a garage in Los Altos in 1976. Now we're the largest personal computer company in the world. We make what we think of as the Rolls-Royce of personal computers. It's a domesticated computer. People expect blinking lights. But what they find is that it looks like a portable typewriter, which, connected to a suitable readout screen, is able to display in color. There's a feedback it gives to people who use it, and the enthusiasm of the users is tremendous. We're always asked what it can do, and it can do a lot of things. But in my opinion, the real thing it is doing right now is to teach people how to program the computer. Before moving on to a booth where a bunch of kids were playing a computer game called Space Voyager, the reporter asks if Steve would mind telling us his age. 22, Mr. Jobs said, speaking off the cuff to a passing journalist from a decidedly non-techie publication. Steve finds so many ways to demystify for the average person the insanely geeky device that he and Woz had created. He understands their fundamental fear that computers may take over too much of modern life, a fear he would capitalize on repeatedly, most notably in the Orwellian imagery of Apple's famous 1984 commercial. He sympathizes with their ignorance. He offers several analogies to comforting examples they will understand. Chevys, typewriters, cameras. Indeed, he makes using a computer seem no more complicated than taking a photograph, going so far as to call the Apple II domesticated. And yet he elevates both his company and its computer into something aspirational. He links this machine, made a few months ago by some disheveled California misfits, to Rolls-Royce, a 73-year-old paragon of sophisticated industrial manufacturing and elite consumer taste. He even calls Apple a world leader, an absolutely unprovable claim that rockets the little company into the same league as IBM and Deck and Burroughs, which were then the industry's giants. He was an extraordinary extemporaneous speaker, and McKenna helped him wield that tool to great effect. Two key improvements to the Apple II sent its sales skyward. First, the company incorporated a floppy disk drive that made loading software much easier. Then, in 1979, VisiCalc became the very first massive software hit. VisiCalc was a relatively simple financial modeling spreadsheet, and its existence suddenly gave non-geeks a concrete reason to own a computer, as they realized how much time they could save handling accounting chores, managing inventory lists, and trying out business scenarios. Suddenly, Apple enjoyed an unprecedented meteoric rise. It manufactured computers that cost more than $1,300 a pop. So when unit sales quickly ramped up into the tens of thousands per month, Apple became the electronic equivalent of a gusher. Sales rose from $7.8 million in 1978 to $47 million in 1979, and all the way up to $117.9 million in 1980, the year of its initial public offering, IPO in Wall Street parlance. No other company had ever grown that fast. The mainstream media began to take note, with publications like Esquire, Time, and Business Week starting serious coverage. Inc. went so far as to put Jobs on its cover, with the hosanna of a headline, "This man has changed business forever." But the rosy picture obscured the many problems within Apple, problems that were inherent in the company's motley mix of leaders. Each of Steve's informal outside mentors had been able to cleverly exploit his own idiosyncratic talents in a corporate setting. Edwin Land was a pioneer whose inventions were dismissed, and yet he'd created a great company by dint of pure stubbornness. Robert Noyce was charismatic and forward-thinking, and had only been able to start Intel after leaving the shadow of the most imposing figure in semiconductor history, William Shockley. The systems that Andy Grove put in place were more complex and rigorous than anything Mike Scott had ever seen. And yet Grove had also been able to make his company one of the most creative places in Silicon Valley. And Regis McKenna became so adept at deftly navigating the constant shifts and tremors of Silicon Valley culture that he would wind up writing several books explaining how others could do the same. These were well-rounded, complicated, deep, and fascinating men. They were comfortable with change, and they lived where Steve wanted to live himself, at the intersection of technology and something that was more like the liberal arts. They were people who played the corporate game by rules of their own devising. It's impossible to say what would have happened next if Steve had had someone like these men as his boss at Apple. Maybe they would have been able to channel his bundle of contradictions to good purpose. But you don't get to replay the experiment. What he had instead was Scotty and Markkula. And they, it would now become clear, could not control him. They could barely even channel his creative energy toward useful purposes. The encounter between young Steve Jobs and the broad, real world around him was about to become something more like a slow-motion collision. It would cost him friends, it would cost him his job, and it would leave him without the company he had created. Chapter 3. Breakthrough and Breakdown. Every cliché is built on some truth. The cliché that Steve Jobs was half genius, half asshole, is based largely on his actions during the 9 years that constituted his first tenure at Apple. This is when his highs would shine most famously and when his lows were reprehensible. It was the period when he most sought the limelight and when he was most out of control. He developed followers and he created enemies. This is when his bundle of contradictory qualities unraveled, leaving him and his company at loose ends. These years provide a baseline for the rest of his career. Steve's personal life, which had been chaotic in the scattered, sloppy way of most 20-somethings, especially those throwing themselves at a career without regard for sleep, social life, or family, spun out of control in 1978, when he denied the paternity of his own child. Chrisanne Brennan, who had been his girlfriend for some time, gave birth to their daughter Lisa in May 1978. She was born in Oregon at Robert Friedland's orchard, and 3 days after her birth, Steve flew north to be with her and Chrisanne. But for months afterward, Steve denied he was Lisa's father and refused to pay child support. He even resisted when a court-ordered paternity test established the likelihood that he was the father at 94.4%. It was as if the mere fact of his denial would negate the proof. When he finally started paying child support of $385 a month, He continued to protest that he might well not be Lisa's father. He saw her rarely, letting Chrisanne raise Lisa on her own in a small house in Menlo Park. It would take years for Steve to bring Lisa into his life in any significant way, and later he would repeatedly express deep regret over his behavior. He knew he had made a terrible mistake. The event obviously crossed the line of what anyone would consider acceptable behavior. Lisa has spoken about the distance she felt from her father and the confusion and instability she felt as a child. Chrisanne has spoken and written about this too, creating a picture, albeit one-sided, of a careless, indifferent, and cruel lover and father. When people debate whether Steve was a good or bad man, this is the strongest indictment against him. He was 23 years old when Lisa's birth presented him with a clarion call to accept adult responsibility. He rejected the call as fully as he rejected her. Colleagues he worked with closely knew about Lisa and heard Steve deny his paternity and complain about being pursued by Chrisanne. Arthur Rock would later describe Steve's behavior as delusional. Especially for someone as unsentimental as Rock, Steve's behavior tied into a pattern of irresponsibility that was developing at Apple. Whether working with his ostensible superiors, such as Rock, or making decisions that widely affected subordinates, Steve could seem indifferent to the impact of his choices. He conveyed a lack of empathy. This behavior only worsened in the year after Steve's visit to the Garden of Allah, when Apple made a big splash by going public. Several years later, Jobs told Susan Varnes, a financial manager at Apple and at Next, that December 12, 1980, the date of Apple's IPO, was the most important day of his career, because only then was he sure that the folks who had driven Apple's early success would make serious money. But Steve had specifically excluded people like Bill Fernandez and Daniel Kottke, an engineer whom he'd met at Reed, from the options bonanza, even though they had been instrumental in getting Apple started during that summer of 1976 in his parents' garage. Jobs had a bureaucratic rationalization for doing so. They were hourly employees, and therefore not guaranteed the founder's stock that helped make 300 long-time salaried employees millionaires. But Steve's lack of generosity was reflective of something that was starting to seem part of a broader character trait. He had this incredible bandwidth, explains Lee Clow, the Chiat Day ad director who would become Steve's close friend after working on the famous 1984 television ad. But he devoted almost all of it to work. Prioritizing things in this way, especially as an immature young man, made most people in his life replaceable. Fernandez and Kottke, for example, had been important to Steve 3 years earlier, but to Steve's way of thinking, they had not kept up. They were not key contributors to Apple, and therefore to Steve's life anymore. The bigger priority was to reward the people who were improving Apple at present. It was a cold evaluation by a young man whose work life was exploding into something much bigger than he had ever anticipated. But his logic carried an emotional cost the young man didn't even consider. Kottke and Fernandez and others like them felt snubbed and unappreciated. Steve's behavior isolated him within the company. He had little sense at this point of how important it can be to have true allies in a corporate setting. It was a blind spot that would catch up to him eventually. After the IPO, Steve was worth $256 million. That widely publicized number, along with the fancy cars that started appearing in the Apple parking lot and the talk of country homes and expensive vacations, contributed to a sense within the company that the offering had created a set of winners and losers. Apple, which had grown from a handful of people in 1977 to 2,900 employees by the summer of 1981, was riven in more ways than one. In the fall of 1980, its headcount had doubled in just 3 months. Apple old-timers took to calling that short stretch of time the bozo period and scorned the newbies. Steve was rarely showy about his newfound wealth. but he widened the rifts in the company in other solipsistic ways. Broadly speaking, Apple employees were focused either on supporting and milking the revenue from the Apple II or on exploring new products. The Apple II was the breadwinner driving the company's growth. The work going on around it was the classic incremental work of improving and deepening the usefulness of a product so that it would be successful for years. Apple II staffers built an extensive retail sales channel of hundreds of resellers, worked with the emerging world of software developers to ensure that they had the necessary tools to write more interesting software that would attract even more buyers, and labored on follow-up machines, like the Apple IIe and the Apple IIgs. Their work paid off. The Apple II and its various models was a remarkably resilient product, selling nearly 6 million units before it was finally discontinued in 1993. For a decade, the company would depend on Woz's reliable old Apple II to fuel its soaring growth. Indeed, it wasn't until 1988 that Macintosh revenues at long last exceeded those from Apple II sales. It didn't take long for Steve, whose official job was to head up product development, to simply stop caring about the Apple II. He felt, in his bones, as he liked to say, that Apple would need a great new product, that the industry was moving at such a rapid pace that the company would be fatally wounded if all it had to offer were slightly improved versions of the Apple II. He made his feelings very clear and suggested that any engineer or marketer worth his salt would be drawn to working on the creation of the next breakthrough product with him. While Steve's narrow attitude slighted scores of the company's hardware and software designers, it was especially insulting to Woz, who eventually chose to nurse along the Apple II rather than join the Mac team. "Some Apple II engineers were being treated like they didn't exist," Woz would later say. As the company grew, he and Steve couldn't help but grow apart. In a broad way, Steve was correct in thinking that Apple needed a significant new offering, and soon. The best recipe for maintaining steadily rising revenues in the computer hardware business is to have a breakthrough product ready just when your last breakthrough is reaching the peak of its own success. Markkula, Scotty, and the board all agreed that the company urgently needed a new model, ideally one better tailored to the needs of office workers. IBM, which had been the sleeping elephant of the industry, had reportedly started studying the possibility of building its own personal computer. The device would eventually make it to market in the summer of 1981. So, in 1978, the Apple board gave Steve the budget and the engineering talent to go ahead and start developing a successor to the Apple II. The personal computer industry was in its infancy, and everyone was flying blind, including Steve. One important thing he didn't yet understand was that most breakthrough products result from a long cycle of hit-and-miss prototypes, the steady accumulation of features, and a timely synthesis of existing technologies. He and Woz, on the contrary, had stuck their heads down, worked hard, and on their very first try created something brilliant that the industry had never before seen. That was Steve's idea of product development, but he was about to discover that that wasn't the way it worked inside a corporation. The company had concrete and meaningful goals for its new machine to be called the Apple III. It would be aimed at the office as well as the home, and would support a color monitor that displayed 80 characters of text on each line, twice as many as the original Apple II. Since a typical typewritten document can accommodate 80 characters per line, the Apple III would compete head-on with specialized word processing computers from Wang Laboratories that over the past 2 years had cascaded into offices across the United States and Europe in even greater numbers than the Apple II had landed in people's homes. Done right, the new model would have been Apple's entree into the corporate market for personal computers. The success of the Apple I and the Apple II had given Steve a little too much confidence in his own technical judgment. He made a series of bad decisions that would be hard to undo later, the most important being his edict that the Apple III, whose footprint had to be small enough to leave lots of open room on an office desk, would be absolutely silent, which meant no internal cooling fan. This slowed the development process to a crawl, because engineers had to figure out how to create convection currents to draw heat away from the motherboard, which held all the semiconductor chips, as well as from the power supply. Without a fan, those components could make the innards of a small computer hot as a pizza oven. The solution the engineers finally came up with was to make the cabinet itself act as a heat sink to help draw out and dissipate the heat. However, that meant making it out of cast aluminum, a good heat conductor, but a material that added considerably to the cost and complexity of manufacture. It wasn't just Steve's demands that slowed the Apple III. Since Apple would be wooing customers who might have purchased an Apple II, the company had to make sure that the software created for the II would also run on the III. This backwards compatibility was an annoying requirement that was far more complicated than Steve imagined, and the time his engineers spent learning to accomplish it slowed the project almost as much as his fussy hardware demands. Steve pushed the Apple III engineers relentlessly to solve these problems quickly. It didn't matter to him that these were gnarly problems to solve. Accustomed to Woz's magical ability to defy old boundaries and technical obstacles, he expected these new hardware and software engineers to do the same. They couldn't. Steve's impatience with the nuts and bolts of corporate life was understandable. Steve was a visionary. It's a word that is loosely tossed around these days, especially in Silicon Valley, but it legitimately applied to Steve even from very early in his life. He had the ability to see around corners, to envision how the seeds of existing ideas could be combined to create something unimaginable to others. The challenge he faced was to become an effective visionary. That's what turns a dreamer into someone who changes the world. A few weeks before he made that drive up to the Garden of Allah in late 1979, Steve had decided, at the urging of Bill Atkinson, Jeff Raskin, and several other Apple technical employees, to check out some work being done by a well-known computer scientist named Alan Kay and some other engineers at Xerox Corporation's Palo Alto Research Center, just a 10-minute drive up the peninsula from Cupertino. PARC, as it was known, would become famous for developing the concepts behind any number of important technologies, including Ethernet local area networking, high-resolution video monitors, laser printing, and object-oriented programming. That summer, Xerox had joined a number of venture capital firms in a $7 million secondary investment round in Apple. As part of the deal, Steve sold $1 million worth of his own stock to the investors, and in return had agreed to give Apple a peek at its most advanced technologies, or as people in Silicon Valley like to say, to open the kimono. These visits were nothing short of an epiphany for Steve, because the technology at PARC was the visual expression of everything he believed computers could and should be. It was at PARC that Steve and his group from Apple first saw the nascent technologies that would later become the distinguishing features of the Lisa and the Macintosh, and eventually all personal computers. They were shown a computer that featured a screen that was white, like a sheet of paper, not black. Moreover, that screen had the exact dimensions of standard typing paper, 8.5 inches wide by 11 inches tall. On it were projected black characters, so sharp and shapely, that they looked as if they had been printed on that sheet of paper. The characters had been bitmapped, meaning that each pixel of the screen followed individual instructions from the computer, a radical new technology that gave developers full graphic control of the monitor screen. Previously, they had only been able to place rudimentary white, green, or orange characters on a black screen. Graphical images, other than meticulously arranged agglomerations of standard characters, were out of the question. These bitmapped characters were really just the beginning of the changes. That screen also could display and organize the contents of the machine's digital data storage by means of graphical icons, little symbolic figures a tad smaller than a postage stamp. representing the documents that could be placed inside chimerical folder icons by means of a strange pointing device the geeks at Park called a mouse. This mouse could also be used to directly move a cursor around a document on the screen when writing or editing. To delete a file or a folder, you would throw it in the trash by using the mouse to drag the icon representing a document over to a special icon on the screen that looked like a garbage can, and drop it in. Compared to the black screen with eerie green characters that had preceded it, this graphical user interface, or GUI, pronounced GUI, as it came to be known, represented at least as radical a break as when silent movies shifted to talkies. The Park researchers understood full well how significant a development this was, and were dismayed that Xerox had, in effect, paid for the privilege of giving Steve and the other Apple visitors access to technology this radical and new. They believed, correctly, that Xerox senior management back east was not that interested in building a full-blown computer. Rather, they wanted to create better photocopiers, and perhaps a dedicated word processor to compete with Wang's. Xerox did not come out with a computer using the Park technology until 1981. Called the Star, it was an intriguing device that was sold not to individual consumers but to businesses as part of a networked system of at least three desktop units that sold for about $16,000 each. While it was a capable microcomputer for its time, customers balked at having to shell out $50,000 or so just to get the minimum setup for an office. It had little impact in the marketplace. Steve realized that the Xerox GUI could be the foundation of something very ambitious and very personal. Visual iconography on a screen could make computing almost intuitive for just about everyone. Existing computer interfaces put a wall of arcane commands and typographical symbols that looked like expletives between the user and the results spewed back by the computer. If you replaced those commands with visual icons that could be easily manipulated via a mouse, harnessing the data processing power of a computer might feel more like going to the library and pulling a book off the shelf, or like engaging in a discussion with a really smart friend or teacher. This interaction, this feeling of comfort with the back and forth with a computer, could lead to the realization of Steve's overarching goal, the creation of a truly personal computer for ordinary people. Steve even had a metaphor for what that computer could be, a bicycle for the mind. After visiting Park, he was a changed man. These were technologies he wanted to bring to everyone in the world. Now Steve faced the challenge of delivering on this promise within the gnawing confines of Apple. It would be a staggeringly ambitious project, one that no one at Apple but Steve could have imagined, and one that no one but he could have made so maddeningly complicated. The long road had many detours and would be pockmarked with collateral damage, but it would eventually lead to the introduction of the Macintosh computer in 1984. After that visit to Xerox Park, Steve completed what had been a slow abandonment of the Apple III development. The more he realized that the machine was simply a modest renovation of the Apple II, the more his attention wandered. Now, he turned away completely, with the intention of applying what he'd learned at Park to another computer already under development at Apple. This machine was specifically designed for Fortune 500 companies that required heavy-duty networked computing to accomplish tasks that were significantly more data-intensive than anything that could be handled by the Apple II, or even the Apple III. The Lisa, as this machine was dubbed, had been gestating since mid-1978, without making much progress. So when Steve assumed full control of the project in early 1980, the team felt a brief spurt of optimism. Steve told them that he fully intended to have the Lisa be the first computer to feature a graphical user interface and a mouse. They had, he told them, a chance to make history. He asked Bill Atkinson, the project's lead software architect, how long it would take to translate what they'd seen at Park into software that could be run on Elisa. Atkinson predicted that he could do it in a mere half a year, missing the mark by some 2.5 years. Clearly, Steve wasn't the only person at Apple who could confuse a clear vision for a short path. Steve's brief management of the Lisa project revealed all his weaknesses. Once again, he couldn't resolve the disparity between the corporate demands for this computer and his own ambitions. The Lisa was supposed to be for businesses, but Steve focused almost exclusively on what would make the machine accessible and friendly for an individual. Once again, he had the right idea for the long run. Years later, easy-to-use computers would make personal computing ubiquitous across businesses, both small and large, without the perspective needed to succeed in the short term. He paid lip service to the special needs of corporations and institutions, but what really fascinated him were the rounded edges of the icons on the Lisa's desktop interface. Atkinson and his programmers did create significant improvements on what they'd seen at Park. The Lisa project is where the modern user interface concepts of overlapping windows, seamless scrolling, and the mouse came into their own. But Steve was a failure at managing this group, in large part because he didn't offer them a unified vision to rally around, given that his own interests were not those of the target audience, business users. When the project stalled, as was inevitable, Steve lashed out, excoriating the team and threatening to bring in Woz, who could surely get things done better and faster. Scotty tried to help Steve out by recruiting Larry Tesler, one of Xerox PARC's own top researchers, and a group of his associates to try to bring a little more discipline and focus to the project. But 2 months after Tesler's hire, Scotty looked at where the Lisa was headed and saw that the computer he had been counting on to represent Apple in the all-important business market was going to be too late, too expensive, and most likely a muddled mess of a machine. In the fall of 1980, Scotty kicked Steve off the team after only 9 months of being in charge and handed its management over to a former Hewlett-Packard senior engineering exec named John Couch. Twice now, in rapid succession, Steve had failed when trying to lead a team to create a computer for the business market. While more and more people in the computer industry were keenly in tune with the needs of enterprise customers, Steve wasn't one of them. Steve's instinctive problems with authority, his inability to successfully manage large teams, his failure to adapt his strengths to the needs of his admittedly weak bosses, were wreaking havoc. The launch of the Apple III was a disaster. The computer didn't ship until May 1980, a year later than planned, and sold for a base price of $4,340, more than double its target price. Within weeks, many buyers were returning their machines and demanding refunds after an alarming number of Apple IIIs started suffering catastrophic failures due to overheating. In some cases, the motherboard got so hot that the solder softened and chips popped out of their sockets. All told, 14,000 had to be replaced. The aluminum chassis worked fine for dissipating heat. The problem turned out to be that the parts had been nestled too closely to one another on the circuit board. Moreover, backwards compatibility had proved so thorny that very few programs were available out of the gate, so the computers that did happen to work weren't particularly useful. The Apple III was an unmitigated commercial failure, selling only 120,000 units before it was discontinued in 1984. During that same time, the company sold nearly 2 million Apple IIs. The pressure to get things right, which was amped up considerably now that the company's stock was widely held, fell mainly on Scotty. But Jobs undercut his boss again and again. He humiliated suppliers that Scott had wooed. He complained endlessly and publicly about little things like the color of laboratory benches, and he repeatedly interfered with Scotty's production schedules by insisting on the completion of inconsequential details. Steve's own failures did nothing to chasten him. In fact, they only heightened his antipathy for Scotty, who was trying to balance the competing needs of thousands of employees. Steve didn't accept the idea of compromise when it came to his own ideas, and so he turned every decision that didn't go his way into a confrontation. The battles between the two became known within the company as the Scotty Wars. Having such a difficult partner was just one of Scotty's many frustrations, and finally it all became too much. Bit by bit, he disintegrated into an unreliable leader of a company that needed a firm hand. He started to develop some physical ailments, which seemed clearly related to stress. When he finally decided to repair some of the damage resulting from the bozo period by laying off some staff, he did so at a company-wide meeting in March 1981, at which he admitted to all present that he didn't find running Apple to be all that much fun anymore. Soon after that, the board agreed that Scotty had to go. He departed after taking one last shot with a letter that attacked what he saw as a culture of hypocrites, yes-men, and empire builders. Of course, the divided culture was as much his fault as anyone else's. But Steve knew that Scotty had borne the heaviest load as Apple morphed from a startup into a real operation. After his departure, Steve reportedly experienced a sudden bout of guilt. He was quoted as saying, "I was always afraid that I'd get a call to say that Scotty had committed suicide." On a September day in 1981, just a couple of months after Scotty's departure, Bill Gates visited the Apple campus in Cupertino. The 26-year-old CEO of Microsoft made the trip fairly often, since his company worked closely with Apple on programming languages for software developers. At the time, Steve was far richer and far more well-known. Gates, however, was the far more precocious and astute businessman. After dropping out of Harvard, Gates had started Microsoft in 1975 in Albuquerque, New Mexico, with his prep school programming buddy Paul Allen. Albuquerque was home to MITS, the maker of the Altair computer that had so excited the homebrew hobbyists. Gates and Allen wrote a piece of software called an interpreter that made it possible for hobbyists to write their own programs for the Altair in the simple but popular basic programming language. MITS opted to bundle the program with each Altair it sold, and Microsoft was in business. The fortunate son of a prominent Seattle attorney and an accomplished civic-minded mother, Gates came to business naturally. After he and Allen discovered that hobbyists were giving away pirated copies of their Altair basic interpreter, Gates wrote a kind of manifesto, asserting that developers of software for microcomputers should be paid for their programs. If that happened, Gates predicted, an entirely new kind of software industry would arise that would benefit software developers, microcomputer makers, and users alike. This would represent a huge change. At that point, software development was mostly in the hands of the makers of computer hardware, who buried the development costs in the final price of the devices they sold. The prospect of making money by building software, Gates believed, would spur innovation and help the new microcomputer manufacturers take better advantage of the breakneck pace of improvement in semiconductor technology promised by Moore's Law. Gates's manifesto was every bit as significant as Moore's Law in the explosion of personal computing. Software development requires very little capital investment, since it is basically intellectual capital, pure thought stuff, expressed in a set of detailed instructions written in a language that machines can understand. The main cost is in the labor required to design and test it. There is no need for expensive factories, or for the invention of fabrication equipment and processes. It can be replicated endlessly for practically nothing. And the prospect of hundreds of thousands of potential customers, or even more, means that developers don't have to charge enormous prices. Gates was right. Accepting the fact that software was worth paying for led to the emergence of a dynamic new industry. One could argue that Gates's greatest contribution to the world was not Microsoft, or the MS-DOS, or Windows operating systems, or the office productivity applications that hundreds of millions of people use. It was his role as the first champion of the concept that software itself had value. The mind that could envision all that was a mind suited for the organizational matrixes of the corporate world. In those early days, Microsoft never lacked for enlightened leadership, unlike Apple. On that September morning in 1981, IBM shipped its first personal computer. Steve had always derided Big Blue as a lumbering monstrosity, and truly believed that no discerning buyer would ever prefer a microcomputer from IBM to one made by Apple. Gates, on the other hand, knew this might be the beginning of something big. His MS-DOS operating system software sat on every IBM PC that went out the door, and he had witnessed the speed with which IBM's Don Estridge and Bill Lowe had steered their PC project around IBM's hidebound bureaucracy. In fact, their rush to market had led them to acquiesce to a historic deal with Gates, allowing him the right in the future to license MS-DOS to other computer makers. It was a decision they would forever regret, since it ultimately tilted power from hardware manufacturers to Microsoft, thereby proving the validity of Gates's manifesto and setting the stage for virtually the entire industry to adopt MS-DOS as a standard that would marginalize Apple, which did not license its operating system. But on that fall afternoon, no one Gates spoke to at Apple seemed aware that their world was about to change, much less acted worried. Years later, Gates remembered that, "I kept walking around asking, isn't this a big deal?" But no one seemed concerned. With Scotty's departure, Mike Markkula became president and Jobs was elevated to chairman. At a moment when it was about to be blindsided by IBM and by the series of clone computer companies like Compaq that would follow in Big Blue's wake, Apple was led by two men who didn't want and weren't suited for the positions they held. Steve's reckless immaturity and authority issues had left the company rudderless, and Markkula was an ambivalent leader who did little to give staffers a clear sense of direction. Apple muddled along this way for several months before finally getting serious about the search for a new CEO by hiring Jerry Roche, the chairman of the renowned headhunting firm Heidrick and Struggles, to handle the quest for a new boss. Roche was the man who introduced Steve to John Sculley. Steve's personal courtship of Sculley, then the president of PepsiCo, has been endlessly documented. It's the story of two men who saw exactly what they wanted to see in the other, who salivated at the thought of how pairing up might transform their lives, and who both wound up sorely disappointed. Sculley was a soda pop and snack food executive, a 43-year-old native New Yorker who was the product of the best prep school and Ivy League educations that money could buy, graduating from Brown and getting his MBA at Penn's Wharton School. He made a name for himself at Pepsi designing Taste It and Rate It advertising campaigns like the Pepsi Challenge and bringing new innovation to supermarket aisle end cap promotions and other cosmetic marketing ploys. He was a great champion of consumer research to determine how best to refine product offerings. Despite his dismissive penchant for ignoring Scotty and Markkula, Steve was fully aware that he still had much to learn about the world of business. In Sculley, he thought he had found an open-minded Fortune 500 exec who would be the in-house mentor he thought he wanted and the enlightened, disciplined leader for a company breaking into the big time. As Steve spun tales of Apple's potential, Sculley seemed full of ideas of how his expertise could fuel Steve's notion of where the company should go. The fact that he played hard to get only heightened Steve's infatuation. He turned down Apple's initial offer of a salary of $300,000 a year, plus options for 500,000 shares of Apple stock, which at the time were worth about $18 million. On March 20, 1982, the two met at the Carlyle Hotel for the signature moment of their courtship. They wandered around Central Park and the Metropolitan Museum of Art before winding up at the San Remo apartment building on Central Park West. A two-story penthouse apartment in one of the building's distinctive twin towers was vacant and for sale, and Steve had been mulling making